Play and stay on Washington State's Kitsap Peninsula, the natural side of the Puget Sound. Stand up paddleboarding, hiking, great restaurants and breweries. I'll tell you more about your next vacation destination later in the show. I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal, the show where celebrities share stories about the foods they love most, and we dig into the history, culture, and science of those meals with experts from around the world. And this week, we are doing something different. Remember those gloriously rare occasions in school when you'd have a substitute teacher and you got to watch a movie instead of doing math or reading Shakespeare? Well, this is the podcast equivalent. Your substitute teacher this week is Mark Bittman, host of the podcast Food. Mark, of course, is a prolific cookbook author. You most likely have one of his 30 books on your shelf. He wrote about food for the New York Times for 30 years. He has 6 James Beard Awards, and he was a guest on this show in 2021. So if you haven't listened to that episode, it's definitely worth scrolling back for. Today, you're going to hear an episode of Mark's podcast, Food, where he was lucky enough to interview another prolific writer, David Sedaris, one of America's favorite humor writers, and to be honest, someone I haven't been able to book on my show. So I am living vicariously through Mark, and I am stoked to give you a little bit of David Sedaris talking about food. Back in December, I was on a flight from Morocco to Paris, and I was reading David Sedaris's latest book of essays. It's called Happy Go Lucky, and I was so caught up in the story that I forgot where I was, and I loudly guffawed a couple of times. I quietly snorted a couple of times when I was trying not to guffaw. And when the plane landed and everybody stood up in the aisle and they were waiting to get off, the woman sitting across the aisle from me was like, "What are you reading? I heard you laughing. I have to know what you're reading." And we ended up having a super fun conversation about books and our lives. She became my airport buddy. She helped me navigate the Paris airport train system. So not only will David Sedaris make you laugh, he might help you make friends. Anyway, Mark Bittman is a fantastic, super down-to-earth interviewer. I listen to his podcast Food every week. David Sedaris is the best kind of bizarre and obviously an amazing storyteller. So I am looking forward to you enjoying this episode. In segment one, they do some storytelling and getting to know each other. And then they really get into talking about food in the second segment of the show. So enjoy your substitute teacher. I will be back with our regularly scheduled programming in 2 weeks. I have a very special guest, an episode I'm looking forward to sharing with you. But for now, here is Mark Bittman's Food with David Sedaris.
So here I am with David Sedaris, mid-COVID, talking bathing while cooking, him, growing up with a dad who came to the dinner table basically naked every night, him, and the do's and don'ts of Jell-O, also him. It's a beaut. It's a hoot. It's a great one. Enjoy it. Thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. I last saw you at Oberlin because my stepdaughter Figure graduated from there. You told the priest joke, which is in A Carnival of Snackery.
Well, that man rushed the stage.
And then that guy rushed the stage.
They held him back, but he kept trying to get at me. You know, two people were holding him back. And he's like, "I'll get you." And it was interesting because you're at Oberlin, right? And so you're expecting to be condemned
from the left.
Yeah, from the left. And instead, I got it from the one right-wing person, the father of the one Republican who ever attended Oberlin College.
Wasn't he yelling? I think he was a priest or something. Anyway, we'll get to jokes. Well, actually, since there are a number of jokes in the book, and this is one of them, maybe you could tell us this joke. But also, I would like to know what your favorite jokes are in the book.
Okay. Well, when I gave the commencement address, it's hard for me. Have you ever done one?
No, I've never done a commencement address.
They're a good assignment, I think, but it's a tough assignment at the same time. So, you know, you want to be hopeful and you don't want to make it all about yourself. And I gave one at Princeton a few years ago. And just before I began, they said, you know, you're going to be in the chapel and the acoustics aren't very good. So you need to speak slowly. And you have to write something for that pace. I mean, you can't just take what you've got and slow it down. And then most of the audience was outside the chapel, and I couldn't see or hear them, so I really had no idea what was going on. But at Oberlin, I thought, well, I'll just give some advice. You know, I know a few things. And so I started keeping a list of, okay, what am I pretty certain of? And one thing is you have to be really careful about scented candles. You know, there's really only two kinds worth having. And another thing I'm pretty sure about is always have a joke tucked away in your back pocket. And so I said, here's one. Cop stops a car. A couple of priests are riding in. He says, I'm looking for two child molesters. The priests think for a moment. We'll do it, they say. So I told that joke.
As good a two-line joke as there is.
And an angry man rushed the stage. He called me an asshole, is what he did. But I've been called worse, and I still think it was a pretty good joke. And I'm just repeating jokes that I heard. You know, if I knew who to credit, I would credit that person. I mean, I'm not a joke writer, but I'm definitely a joke appreciator. I was walking here today. I walked here from my apartment, and I was at 5th, and I think I was at 49th Street, and this guy tried to sell me a coffin. And I said, that's the last thing I need.
But do you think that funny things happen around you? Like, no one's ever tried to sell me a coffin.
Oh, no, that's a joke. Get it?
Oh, I see. It's a joke.
It's the last thing I need, a coffin.
Okay. So it didn't happen.
No.
But funny things do seem to happen to you. I mean, or is it just the way you observe things, do you think?
I don't know what it is. I usually go out after midnight and walk 5 miles, right? Because I have this Fitbit, and I like to wake up with 5 miles under my belt, right? I like to get between 15 and 20 miles a day, but I like to wake up with 5 miles under my belt. So I go out at midnight, and I live on the Upper East Side, so usually I can walk 5 miles at night and pass no one on the sidewalk, especially during the pandemic. But about a week ago, I'm turning off of Park onto 72nd Street, and there's this woman, and she said, I'm just smoking this joint, but it wasn't a joint. I don't know what she was smoking, but I didn't smell marijuana. Anyway, you want a date, baby? And then she just attaches herself to me, and she won't leave me alone. And then I made the mistake of saying, I'm gay. And she said, I'll f*** you up the ass. I'll turn you. And then I go to a building, any building, you know, with a doorman, and the doorman says, are you two together? And as I say no, she says yes. And it turned out she had been there 5 minutes earlier and tried to use the bathroom. So the doorman thinks that I just took pity on her, and I'm like, we'll see about that. I don't live there. And then the woman says, oh, I see. You came here because you want him, right? And the doorman said, what's going on? She said, of me, she said, he's gay. And the doorman said, you don't know that. Maybe he's a family man. And I'm thinking, why are we talking about this? And that kind of thing would never happen, like, to my boyfriend Hugh. And I think it happens to me because I'm small.
That's your theory? Happens to you because you're small?
Yeah. I mean, if I were... the woman was my size, but it's the same thing with people, aggressive people on the street. They come to me. They go to me before they go to anybody else, especially now that I just went down 4 notches on my belt.
This is from walking 20 miles a day.
Actually, it's from eating Jell-O.
Only Jell-O? Is that the...
No, but whenever I'm hungry, I have meals. And then if I get hungry between meals, I reach for sugar-free Jell-O. It fills you right up. The weight just dropped. It just disappeared.
But it's not the 20-mile-a-day thing? Or have you been doing that forever?
I've been doing that forever. Anyway, I think that things happen to me because I'm not on my phone. I don't usually carry it with me. And I don't text and do all that stuff. And so I'm available to make eye contact with people. I think that's part of it, too. Well,
if I could add to that, I mean, that makes total sense. But it sounds like you're on the street a lot, you live in cities, and you pay attention.
Yeah. But even in the country, things happen to me. Yeah.
You've always been funny. You've always had a sense of humor. This is not something you cultivated, or were you a hilarious kid?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have a very funny family. So if I compare myself to them, I'm just, I'm nothing special. I mean, I'm funnier than my boyfriend. I mean, he has some really good qualities, but you would never call him funny. There's somebody who I know who just went into comedy at the age of like 62. And the thing is, like, no one had ever told him in his life that he was funny. I mean, that would be like becoming a model and no one said, oh, my God, you should be a model.
Most of your books are autobiographical, but none is a straight memoir.
No.
Is that something that interests you? Is that something you might do at some point?
I have a 12-page attention span, so I'm not interested in writing anything that's more than 12 pages long. I mean, every now and then I'll stray to like 13, but partly because I go on these tours and I read things out loud. I would never get on stage and read something that was 45 minutes long or an hour long. Nobody wants that. I prefer to read a number of shorter things. So if I read something and you're not into it, you know, give it 10 minutes and I'll read something else.
Are there particularly scandalous diary entries that you've left out?
No. I mean, I don't. There are certain things I don't write about in my diary even. So I don't write about sex, but like at my age, I don't know how scandalous. I think the scandal would just be that I have it. You know?
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more food in just a minute.
Have you been to Washington State's Kitsap Peninsula? If you are planning your spring and summer adventures like I have been, you're going to want to add the Kitsap Peninsula to your list. There are so many charming little waterfront towns like Paul's Bow and Bainbridge Island, lush forests for hiking, water trails for kayaking. There are breweries, wineries, restaurants, and farmers markets. And all of that is located west of Seattle, just across the Puget Sound. When I travel, I am always looking for places like this. Beautiful places where the locals go to vacation. And today I'm going to tell you about Port Orchard and Olalla, where you can rent a stand-up paddleboard, you can take a hike in Manchester State Park, taste some wines and see live music at Olalla Winery, and head down to the Port Orchard waterfront to do some shopping and have a delicious meal. Whether it's a day trip or a whole weekend, play and stay on the Kitsap Peninsula, the natural side of Puget Sound. Go to visitkitsap.com/yourlastmeal. And Kitsap is K-I-T-S-A-P. If you like listening to Your Last Meal, you also might like my brand new TV show. It's called The Nosh with Rachel Bell, and there are brand new episodes every Friday in April. We get into everything from bagels, are there only good ones in New York City, to the ever-expanding, exciting world of non-alcoholic drinks, and lots of other fun stuff in between. Watch The Nosh from anywhere in the world at cascadepbs.org, or if you're in Washington State or BC, you can check it out on Channel 9 every Friday in April at 8:50 p.m. And to make it easy, I put a link in the show notes. Thanks, friends.
Okay, I need to do my due diligence and talk about food before we run out of time. You mentioned you have four sibs and you write about your family. Your family is maybe even beloved and well-known to some extent. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ate growing up? Who cooked? What you ate, that kind of stuff?
Sure. We had six kids, and my father is super cheap. I mean, super cheap. So he never trusted my mother to grocery shop. He clipped coupons, and he would go to four stores. He'd go to two on Friday and two on Saturday, right? And we liked going with him just because, you know, just because it got us out of the house. But he would go to the grocery store. He would march into the back in the produce department and find whatever they're about to throw out.
Boy, he really was cheap.
Yeah. And so all of the vegetables were limp, you know, like it would be a carrot, but it would just, if you held the green part, the other part would just droop down. Like I didn't even know that vegetables had texture until I left the house. Yeah. One thing that's interesting, like it wasn't, like no one was allowed to say, I only eat white food. Or that touched that, like we weren't allowed to be those children. And so, you know, like my mother made this spaghetti casserole that I remember with cream cheese in it. You know, when you're like in first grade, you're fine with it. But what was interesting is my mom, groceries changed, you know, in the 1980s. All of a sudden, sun-dried tomatoes appeared. Remember when sun-dried tomatoes, and everyone was like, oh my God, sun-dried tomatoes, which actually, I don't like them.
They're not that good.
No. But in 1980, everyone was so excited about them. And I remember we went to my sister Gretchen's graduation from RISD, And we went to Il Forno, a restaurant in Providence, Rhode Island. And it was the first time I'd ever had Northern Italian food. Because we had like the Villa Capri in Raleigh, which was, you know, when I look back on it now, I mean, you know, the cutlets probably came already frozen and they were all at the same size. And, you know, when you go to Italy, it's nothing like the Villa Capri.
The Villa Capri gets its food off the back of the Cisco truck is how we put it usually.
But when we were kids, you know, when I would go to the Villa Capri, like, oh my God, are you kidding? But the important thing I feel like, you know, when we became teenagers and it was like, okay, David, you're making dinner tonight, right? So we had the, like, the cookbook for children, you know, so I made my meatloaf in the shape of a wreath and I made my chicken cacciatore and but we all learned to cook that way and it would be our turn to make dinner. But I feel like the most important thing was that we ate dinner at the table every night. And my father, he always ate dinner in his underpants, always. He came home from work and he took his pants off as if they
boxer
were like—
boxer shorts?
No, briefs.
Briefs.
He took his pants off until he went to work the next day. He just kind of wandered around in his underpants. And
that was his idea of luxury.
Someone would knock on the door and be like, oh, you know, trying to beat dad to the door before he could open it. But so he would leave the table the second he could. But the rest of us would sit around the table for hours and hours and hours every night, you know. And when we got to be teenagers, it wasn't like we had dates. Nothing would pull you away from the table. And to me, I feel so fortunate to have grown up with that. You know, Hugh and I now, you know, every night we eat at the table, you know, with candles on the table and we don't eat in front of the TV. We don't eat standing up. I mean, often at book signings, I'll say to people, what'd you have for dinner last night? It's appalling. You know what I mean? Oh, I just put some tuna on crackers and I ate over the sink. That's disgusting. I mean, maybe because I don't drink and I don't do drugs anymore, all I have to look forward to is dinner. And Hugh is an amazing cook. We've been together for 30 years. And so I'm 64, so in 2 years, I will have known him for half my life. And he started off, he moved to Paris. He grew up in Africa. His dad was a diplomat. And so the meat was pretty sketchy, you know, in Somalia and the Congo and Ethiopia. So he was a vegetarian as a kid. And then he moved to Paris after college and got a job cooking for a family. And they wanted meat. So he learned to cook meat, and then he started eating meat again. But he's not the kind of cook where, you know, he takes the rice and then puts it into like a cat food can and then so it's in a little mold and then there's things piled up on top of it. He's a basic, like he can really roast a chicken. And people are, it's like they never had chicken again when they come over to our house. And also he knows how to find the right chicken. You know, he's happy to spend 4 hours making dinner, but he's not a snob about it, right? Because when I cook, I want to put everything in the oven, and then I want to take a bath for half an hour. And when I get out of the tub, I want everything to be ready.
You could do that. It happens. You answered a lot of questions I was going to ask you, so thank you for anticipating that. I just want to have some idea of your mother cooking with these sort of ingredients that your father would shop for. Would he say, you know, here's what you've got. You've got limp carrots and limp celery. You've got some meat that might go bad tomorrow. And she would be like, fine, I'll do what I can with it.
She did what she could. But again, it was, you know, Spanish rice we would have. I mean, stuff that kids like, chipped beef on toast. You know, we'd have a roast on Sunday, but it was like, eat it quick because it expired at noon.
Is there anything in particular that you love to eat other than Hugh's cooking or anything in particular that you can't stand?
Well, it was a real surprise to, you know, I wanted to quit smoking. And so I thought, I'll just move to Tokyo because you can't smoke on the street in Tokyo. You have to go to a special smoking station and they're not always easy to find. And it's not like you just smoke on the street anyway, because people there follow the rules. I mean, the first time I went there, I was still smoking, and I left the train station, and I lit a cigarette, and I looked around me. It seems like there were hundreds of thousands of people in my sight, and not a one of them was smoking. And so I put the cigarette out, and then I didn't see any butts on the ground, and I didn't see any trash cans. So that's why I always wear cuffed trousers, you know, because you can put your cigarette butts into the trouser, under the cuff of your pants until you found a trash can. And it was such a surprise to me. I guess I had just a really, you know, my notion of Japanese food was pretty basic. You know, I thought, oh, they eat sushi and they eat tempura. And it was interesting to be there long enough and meet Japanese people and go out with Japanese people. And I remember I was out with my friend Akira and his wife. Our lunch came in a box with many compartments in it. And I was pointing to what looked like a marble in the bottom. And I said, what is this? And he said, we don't know what we're eating either. And I thought that was interesting. And I also thought it was very interesting in Japan that I've never heard anybody just chit-chat with the waiter or waitress. And I asked Akira about that. I said, I never see anybody just chatting with the supermarket cashier or with a waitress. Why don't you ask people about their lives? And he said, because we don't care.
This is a great answer. It's formalized. Yeah, you might not do well there, actually. It's sort of the opposite of how you're used to interacting with people.
But just the wide range of Japanese food that, and we usually try to go once a year, every winter, we call it Japanuary. We go in January. That's constantly surprising to me. But, you know, if I could only eat one country's food, I would eat Italy's food. I think they dropped the ball on dessert, but I think they wrote the book on dinner.
A lot of people would agree with you, I think.
I can't eat chocolate. And so a lot of people pity me because I get an insane headache when I eat it. But I haven't eaten in so long, I don't care. But it just makes you realize so many people's idea of dessert is chocolate. Like on the airplane, when they say, we've got chocolate cake and we've got chocolate ice cream.
Right. My younger daughter doesn't eat chocolate. She doesn't like it. And everybody's always trying to get her to eat it. Like, it's so great. You should eat it. She's like, leave me alone.
Well, I said to somebody, I was signing books years ago, and a vegan came up, and I said, oh, you need to at least eat chicken. And she said, what possible business is it of yours what I eat? And I really heard her, and I thought, oh, my God, you're so right. And so I never say that to people anymore. But that said, I mean, we lived in France for a number of years. And I don't recall a single French house guest who said, I don't eat blank. And we had a dinner guest in Paris one night. We had two Americans, and one was a vegan, and the other one was a vegetarian, and she couldn't eat wheat. You know, like, what are you supposed to do?
I cook for people, you know, 50 years I've cooked for people who've come over, and it is getting harder and harder. You have to ask everybody. It's not polite to not ask, and you sort of expect that people are going to tell you they're not going to sacrifice what their allergies are or what their principles are because you're cooking for them, and it just becomes increasingly this kind of lowest common denominator cooking. Like, what can I make that's not going to trigger an allergy attack, offend this person, et cetera, et cetera? It's a tightrope a little bit.
Well, when I moved to France because I didn't eat chocolate, I thought, okay, I can't add to that list. Right? So we went to somebody's house for dinner one night and she served liver. And I just always thought liver was gross. And I thought, well, I can't not eat it. And it was fantastic. Oh, and just the door to liver opened. And it wouldn't have opened if I'd been able to say, well, you know, I don't remember liking it when I was six.
But that's the other thing, is having a food preference is not the same thing as having an allergy or having a special diet or whatever. So there is this kind of like, well, someone's inviting you for dinner. It's not up to you to tell that person what you like. It's fine if you have an allergy or some kind of diet. But if you say, well, I don't really like chicken, or I don't really like broccoli, whatever.
Like, it wasn't until I moved to France that I started eating horse. And horse is fantastic. And it's even better in Belgium. And I've had horse in Japan, but it's always been cold.
Cold raw?
And cut into like pieces the size of dice. I don't remember if it was raw or, I guess you could eat raw horse, right? I mean, I've had horse tartare before, but a lot of people, I've never rode a horse, you know? I mean, this morning I bought a belt that's made out of an alligator, but alligators are mean, okay? So I'm not going to feel, it's either you or the alligator. So it's not like it's either you or the chicken.
Right.
Right? An alligator can fight back. So I feel pretty okay about this belt.
Last question. What did you eat for dinner last night?
Hugh was in England, And I've been on tour and I came home. So I made
salmon. Tuna fish standing over the sink.
No, I made salmon. And then, you know what I love? Baby zucchini. I love them. And they have them at Grace's Marketplace. And so I steamed some of those and I had this salmon. And then I followed it up with orange Jell-O with oranges in it.
Wow. And you made that or you bought that?
I made the Jell-O. Yeah.
I guess real last question. Let's talk about the sugar-free Jell-O thing because I'm kind of fascinated by that.
Over COVID, I gained a lot of weight. I don't weigh myself, but my shirts didn't fit and then my jackets didn't fit. So I decided I was going to go on a diet for 2 months before my tour started. So I cut what I eat in half. But see, I eat an entire chicken in an entire box of spaghetti, right? That's dinner for me. I mean, I eat massive amounts of food. You know, I walk 15 to 20 miles a day. I don't know if it was the size of my family, but I always worried that there wasn't going to be enough. And so I would wolf down the first helping and then so I could be first with the seconds. And, you know, if I can have thirds, that's great too. My brother eats the way I do. And I watch him sometimes and I realize, oh my God, that's what I look like. When I go on tour, I eat dinner at the book signing table because otherwise I don't get out of there till 1 o'clock in the morning and all the restaurants are closed. And I don't like having my picture taken. And so there's a sign up that says no photos, right? And this woman came up to get a book signed a couple of years ago and she said, after watching you eat for 20 minutes, I can see why you have that sign.
That's great.
So they make this Jell-O and it's 10 calories a serving. So it's 40 calories a box. And a box of Jell-O is like 2 cups, right? Cup of hot water, cup of cold water. And that's 40 calories. 2 crackers is 40 calories.
No, 40 calories is effectively no calories.
But you can fill yourself up. Like I have a problem before I go to bed. I think, oh, what's going on in the kitchen? I mean, my boyfriend Hugh doesn't. He just goes to bed. But I'm like, what's going on in there? And I'll just wipe out any leftovers that there were or see what I can pile on top of a potato chip.
You're a great eater. This is very impressive.
But because I needed to lose weight, I couldn't do it. So I just have, you know, 2 entire boxes of Jell-O. And that's 80 calories.
It's really 4 cups of water is what you're doing.
Yeah. It filled me up. Well, I don't know how much weight I lost, but my jackets fit me. You know, you're supposed to like be able to make a fist and put it on your chest and close your jacket over it. You're supposed to have that much room in your jacket. And there were jackets, they fit me like sausage casings. And now I can put that, I'm going to gain it all back.
Thank you so much for this. It was really fun.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
During the course of the conversation with David, we had, well, I wasn't hilarious. He said some hilarious things about Jell-O and his fondness for it. I told him that it's probably not worth making Jell-O from scratch, which I think he agrees with. But I'll tell you, a gelatin-based dessert that is worth making from scratch, and that's panna cotta. Might be a little ambitious for some people. There are a couple steps here, but if you can start with good cream, this is one of the best desserts there is. So, as I said, start with getting good cream, 3 cups, heavy cream, or if you can only get less, use a mixture of heavy cream and half and half. But this and a little vanilla and sugar are the only flavorings here. So the better the cream, the better the dessert. Take 4 ramekins and very, very lightly grease them with a towel and a tiny bit of oil. Just grease them a bit. Put 1 cup of the cream in a medium saucepan, no heat, and sprinkle an envelope of gelatin, about 2 teaspoons of unflavored gelatin, over the top of that. Let it sit for 5 minutes and it will soften, and then turn the heat under the saucepan to very low and whisk until the gelatin dissolves completely, until the mixture is translucent. That'll take about 3 minutes, maybe 5 at the most. Meanwhile, cut a vanilla bean in half lengthwise and scrape out the seeds with the point of a small paring knife. Add both the seeds and the pod to the cream, along with 1/2 cup of sugar and 2 more cups of cream. As I said, if you don't have that much cream, use some half and half to make up the difference. But again, better cream is going to make this dessert, this panna cotta, much better. Increase the heat to medium and stir until the sugar is dissolved and a little bit of steam starts rising from the pot. Just until then, another 3 or 5 minutes. If you don't have a vanilla bean, you can do this and then add a teaspoon of vanilla extract afterwards. Let the mixture, the cream mixture, which is going to be your panna cotta, cool in the pan for a few minutes. Then remove the vanilla bean with the tongs or whatever and pour the panna cotta into the custard cups. Chill that until it's set, at least 4 hours or up to a day, and then serve in the cups, or you can run a thin knife along their edge and plate them with some berries. That's really great, but without anything. It's one of the most beautiful and amazing desserts in the world. Enjoy that. Okay, it is time for a little audience participation. You can call our question and answer hotline with any question about food at 833-FOOD-POD. That's 833-366-3763. Be sure to leave us a way to get back to you. Hi, Mark Gale. Welcome to Food. Nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I hear you have a unusual circumstance and a question.
I do, and I hope it's unusual, at least for my sake. We discovered an ant infestation in my spice and baking supplies cabinet. And so I had to throw away just about everything. We've basically scrapped the entire spice cabinet and all the baking stuff as well. And so as I rebuild my collection, the opportunity to start from scratch, I would love your thoughts on what are like three spices or seasonings that I should make sure are in the new and improved and vermin-free cabinet.
What type of food do you cook most often?
I tend to start most of my recipes with a base of like olive oil, butter, garlic, and salt.
Well, I wasn't going to suggest garlic powder, so that's good.
Yeah. I would say I lean towards like a Italian or a sort of New Orleans Frenchy style, but you know, but I also do some Asian cooking as well.
Well, you know, I don't see how you can live without some form of ground chilies, unless you have a great source for fresh chilies all the time. So you can go with a milder Urfa chili kind of thing, but Middle Eastern ground chilies tend to be milder. New Mexican ground chilies tend to be milder, or you can go with cayenne. But especially if you're cooking New Orleans food, you're going to want some source of heat. I don't like heat myself all that much, so I tend to rely on pimenton, smoked paprika from Spain, because that has a little bit of heat and it has this smokiness that makes it so you cook with less bacon than you used to cook with. I cook with less bacon than I used to cook with. So I think that's one. I mean, really, you're just asking me what my favorites are. I couldn't live without cumin. I don't think I use cumin every day, but I bet I use it 4 or 5 times a week. I really, really love it. I mean, the thing is that I don't cook with spices at every meal. I cook with olive oil and garlic and onion and a lot of aromatic vegetables. And so I don't always add spices. But when I do, I'm thinking chili or pimenton, cumin. This is a bit of an outlier and I use it less, but I don't think I could live without cinnamon either. And it's like, you know, I'm not even using that. Maybe I use it once a week. But having said all of that, you're only going to buy 3 spices once. Then you're going to buy 3 more. Then you're going to buy 3 more. I mean, I think the problem for most of us is, what about these things that we buy that lie there for 5 years and you think, oh, when am I going to actually use that? So I think the idea of prioritizing is really a good one. And, you know, I think if you want to go to 5 or 10 and after that you think, well, you want cardamom, you want coriander, you might want dry ginger because it's hard to keep that around. I personally love to have saffron around. And if you buy it by the ounce, it lasts forever and isn't all that expensive. Well, others can add to the list. We do not have, or we did not have until the other day, dried oregano, dried marjoram, dried any of the sort of green herb things in our spice cabinet, but we wanted to make za'atar, so we had to buy some dried spices. I think dried oregano is actually, especially if you can get good dried oregano, it's worth having. Marjoram too, I guess. Anyway, just to get you started, what were you thinking? I'm curious.
I put bay leaf on the list immediately. I don't love thyme, but a lot of recipes call for it. So,
yeah, I don't have dried thyme in the cabinet. I use fresh thyme in the summer, and I guess I buy, You know, if you buy so-called fresh thyme on sprigs, even in the winter, it lasts forever.
And then I like celery salt because I also like it on the edge of a Bloody Mary. So serves a dual purpose.
Well, yeah, that's important. It's important to make your drink spices readily available. Okay, well, good luck with the ants. Hopefully no other pests will follow. And great to see you and nice to talk with you.
Nice to see you as well. Thank you so much for answering my question.
Take care. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Again, you can call us with any question you like about food and we will get back to you and maybe have you on the show. The number is 833-FOOD-POD. That's 833-366-3763. I hope you had fun with this episode. I certainly did. Thank you to the prolific banterer, David Sedaris, for coming on the show. We could have gone on forever, but I was trying to be respectful of his time. You can follow him on Instagram at David Sedaris Books. That's DavidSedarisBooks. And on Facebook at David Sedaris. His new book, A Carnival of Snackery, is out tomorrow, October 5th. It's really hilarious. Thank you for joining us. I want to thank Mark Hale also. Thanks to Kate Bittman for putting together a great show. Folks, if you liked today's episode, and if you're still listening, I can assume that you did, then please subscribe to Food with Mark Bittman on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you like to listen. It would be real helpful if you left us a 5-star review on Apple, and detailed reviews are the best way for new listeners to discover the show. You can find the recipe from today's show in the episode show notes or at bittmanproject.com or at markbittman.com. They all kind of go to the same place. Finally, Food with Mark Bittman is a part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Check out Airwave's other shows at airwavemedia.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bittman, and thanks again for listening to Food.
That's it, folks. A special thanks to Kate Bittman, Mark's co-host, producer, and daughter. She wasn't on this episode, but she is on many others, and I can't wait to meet someday and be real life friends. Make sure you're subscribed to Your Last Meal. Follow me on Instagram, Hello Rachel Bell, and please leave us a nice review on Apple Podcasts. It really does help to get the show out to more people. I'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh episode of Your Last Meal. I'm Rachel Bell, and this is Your Last Meal.